I met Brian in 1978 as a Stanford student, and the college pastor that I'd worked with for 3 years was replaced by Brian. And I thought, who is this guy who's come in to take the place of the guy I've been working with for 3 years? Steve Zeisler was his name. Some of you know that name. And so we began to build a relationship, and I was only there with Brian for 4 years. But those were life-shaping years for me. After a couple years, and he'll take credit for this. I think the Lord had something to do with it, but I married my wife, Jeannie, with a little help from Brian. I think Brian helped get us together, bring us together. And he ended up doing our wedding. My car was broken down and in the shop around our wedding time, so Brian loaned us his car, the Toad, little green car, and it sort of looked like a toad. We lived with Brian and Emily for a month while we waited for an apartment to open up. They fed us, took care of us, and kind of kicked us off on our marriage life together, and that was great. And then I got to spend a couple more years working with Brian. But what's amazing to me is that that friendship didn't end after just those 4 years. But I learned a lot in those 4 years. I wrote down some things because I didn't want to forget some things I learned from Brian Morgan during those 4 years and since. One of the things I learned from Brian was a passion for the Bible, especially the Old Testament. And you'll find that out this weekend. Brian loves scriptures, especially loves the Old Testament and the Psalms. I learned a passion for good scholarship. I learned a passion for men. Brian's always discipling guys, and I mean, that's obvious. He brought, what, 8 guys with him or whatever from California. He loves to invest in men. I learned a passion for honesty and openness. What you see with Brian, I mean, he's all out there, and that's what's wonderful about him. It's great. It's honest. I learned a passion for family. I learned a passion for knowing God, especially in times of suffering. And you'll hear some of Brian's story, and the Lord will connect with your own heart in some of your story, too, as you hear his story and some others. And that's a big part of my prayer, that we would all connect with God in a way that's deeper than maybe we ever have as we connect with his suffering and the sufferings of others. One of the other things I learned was a passion for friendship. Never had a friend like Brian. You know, I think in my life, I would say that I can't say that I've ever been a great friend, but I can say that I've had one for 30 years, actually 34 years. And I know other people can say that about Brian because he is a great friend. I can relate to what David said about Jonathan, his friend, after Jonathan died. Your love to me is better than the love of a woman. There's something wonderful about that kind of connection, that kind of friendship. So Brian, come up and let me pray for you and we'll get started. Let's give him a hand, shall we? Lord, thank you for this weekend. Thank you that we get to be here together as men, share our lives together, share our stories, share our hearts. We pray, Lord, that you would be here in a powerful way by your Spirit, that you would connect with us, that you'd speak through your servant Brian, and that we would walk away from this place more deeply engaged with you and with one another. Thank you, Lord, for this time. May you accomplish your purpose in every heart here. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Okay, am I loud enough? Well, I need to tell you what I learned from Jackson. I learned how to bark. And yeah, so that's what I got from Jackson. No. Yeah, it's all man, you know. I can't actually see the slides, but go to the next one. This is my motley crew, Amanda, back home. And you guys need to know that this last Wednesday, every single one of you were prayed for by name, was taken on their lips Wednesday morning for this weekend. And we have some strange characters in there, but it's a great group. As Jackson said, I do have a passion for men. And I always travel in a team because I never know if I'm going to make it home or not. So, Ben, stand up, put on your hats. So, this is a wild crew. They've been around the world with me. Yeah. Stand up. Oh, no, sit down, Ken. This is so. Okay. The neat thing about friendship is you get no respect. And I figured out this is why pastors don't disciple people, because when you disciple people, they know you, and when they know you, they don't respect you anymore. And anyway, but John here in the middle, our blue guy, he's the newest guy in the group. And so I get this call at 8:30 last night, and Brian, yes, I'm in front of your house. You are? Yes, can I come in? So he comes and he says, now, do you think any of your men will be sensitive about wearing a little rabbit fur? I says, these guys shoot everything that moves. You think they cared? So he brought us, you know, these hats. And on them was this label that said Mad Bomber. So when we went through security today at the airport, the agent looks at John and says, so what's this title mean? He goes, well, it's the company name. He says, so you need to think twice. So anyway, we're all a bunch of mad bombers. It's a motley crew. They all have amazing stories. Maybe you'll hear from one or two of them if I can coerce them through the week. So anyway, mazel tov. So that's the brothers. Yeah. And mine's leathered. It has a GPS in it when I get lost and the whole thing. Now, if I get my guys to pass out the books. So let me just tell you about the book. This is a condensed version of a workbook on the Psalms. And tonight, after the session, gosh, you guys are as bad as my guys. Read my lips. Tonight, after the session, if I'm going to kind of go through this opening, but on this introduction to poetry and Psalms, if you want to read before the next session, verses 1 to 14, that'll kind of give you a good review. And then in the morning, I'll be doing Give Me an Authentic Voice, and then your sessions are down here with exercises. So under Retreat Sessions and Exercises. So that's in your just table of contents. And before that, if you want to see my beautiful wife and why I married her, this blonde bomber on the front cover, now a grandmother, but anyway. So another passion of mine is mountains. And when I was a Stanford student, most of the Stanford students went overseas, so I went to Italy. And my first weekend there, all the students going, oh, we're going to Rome. I said, Rome? Are you kidding? You know what the other direction is? It's Switzerland. So I went into the Alps and so this is a family vacation I took. And what's interesting about the Swiss, if there is a view to be had in that country, they want you to see it. So this is taken from our chalet in Wengen, where we stayed for 2 weeks in 2006. Best family vacation I ever had. And there's no cars allowed. So how do you get there? Well, they have these little cog trains that take you up these little steep routes to get to where the cars don't go. But then there's the Jungfrau, that's 13,642 feet. And, you know, the first climbers about lost their lives. You got the Eiger Sanction, you know, and Clint Eastwood trying to get up that thing, the whole thing. But they want you to see the view. So they built this railroad they tunneled through that thing. It took them over 10 years to build. Go ahead, next one. And you get to this train station, you get a little steeper cog train. Next. And you see the arrow here. Well, the slide's not great. There's a little tunnel through there. And then you end up all the way at the top, which looks like that, at 13,000 feet. I don't even know if you can see the people in the slide. Next one. And this is my daughter. So 33 years old. She's still single. Got any guys on Idaho? We have no real men left in California. They are all geeks that do video games. They don't know how to lead. They don't know how to hunt or fish. So I'm begging you, any sons in Idaho? I mean, Jackson's sons, they just kind of get married like that, you know, having kids out of the chute, but, you know. Anyway, I only need 2 milk cows as my dowry. So, anyway, so another beautiful view at the top. Next slide. Now, some mountains you can't get to with a railroad, so you can't get there without a guide. So when I was 19, go back, next slide, this was my guide. And you start at this hut at 12,000 feet. And you follow a guide. And when you get to the top, they've already got these ropes anchored in there. So somebody's been there before, and so you shimmy up. If you don't make it, you end up at the right. Actually, the week after I was there, 4 people were killed because they couldn't hang on. But the weekend I was there, it was so warm, they didn't need gloves. This first clear day in 88 days they had on the mountain. Next slide. And then you get to the top, and wow, you can see all the way to St. Moritz, the whole deal, and you take in the view. So what I've discovered about the scriptures, and it took me a long time to figure it out, if you think about the Hebrew scriptures, most New Testament, the Bible, in terms of how it says what it says, is either two types of literature. It's either stories or it's poetry. And as you observe the scriptures start with story, Genesis, but then you get to these little hinge points where you get a poem. Man's first words is poetry. And you get this rhythm, and that's Adam's words. Then you get another story, poem. And I kind of liken it to the stories of Scripture take you out of your world into a very large world of Abraham or David or, Ezekiel, the prophets. And you start traveling, and God's earlier stories, they shape later stories. And what I've discovered, because I've lived long enough, is that God's life in these stories starts to shape your life, and you find yourself in these stories with these same patterns. I love structures. And that's what stories do. That's why we love movies. You go to church, you're bored, you sleep, but you go to a theater and all of a sudden you're crying because your life's up there and you went in by surprise and you got drawn in unexpectedly and boom, you saw yourself. Now, poetry then, however, stories carry you up the mountain, but the poem is like stops you where you stop to breathe, because you have to rest, and you take in the vista, and you extract the eternal significance of your journey to see its reality. And it's this rhythm. It's just like Sabbath in the Bible. You work, you rest, you work, you rest. And so that the whole scripture is this way. I mean, the gospel isn't illustrated by a story. It is story. It's Israel's story. It's the climax of Israel's story and the whole thing. And the epistles, you know, where we live most of the time, Paul's just telling them where they got the story wrong. And he's corrected them. And then the last book of the Bible is all poetry. So, next slide. So the question is, do you have a voice? David, when he grew up, did not have a voice in his own home. I mean, anybody that's not invited to Christmas dinner and is left taking care of the sheep is one neglected son. When the prophet comes to town, that's a huge event. And to leave David in the field means he's a non-son. And you can tell the way his brothers treat him that he's hated by his brothers. He had no voice. But eventually he gets a voice. And so this whole weekend, I'm not here as a speaker. I am here to give you some tools to give you a voice. Now, next slide. So I'm going to tell you my own journey, acquired my voice. I grew up in a non-Christian home. I hated church kids because they always got me in trouble, so I thought if it was a hell, that's where church kids went. So I never went to church, but at the age of 11, by the way, I grew up in an all-female house, and that's why I have a passion for men. I had 3 older sisters. My dad was a surgeon. He had 2 kids before the war, 2 kids after, with 10 years in between. So I had 3 older sisters, and then I was the boy. It was the apple of his eye. But my dad never spoke. He had 3 words, huh, what, and huh. But as a surgeon, you know, in those era, they were God. And everybody wanted his blessing. And I grew up, the apple of his eye, happy as a young kid. But what happened to me at the age of 11, I was watching this movie, The High and the Mighty. And the Duke is flying this plane, and it's running out of gas. And you don't know if he's going to make it. The tension builds. And just as the plane is about ready to land in LAX from Hawaii, you don't know. He says, "Now I lay me down to sleep." And I thought, wow, if the Duke prays, I should pray. So I went down and got down on my knees, and I said, "Dear God, bless all the crippled children, children with polio, make all the sick children well, bless my mommy and daddy and Andrew and Wendy and Bonnie, amen." And I just said that religiously every night from then on. Then, junior high years, check slide, I was very shy. And I went from a private school where I had 16 in the graduating class. My parents moved to a new neighborhood, an all-Jewish neighborhood. I didn't know one person. And they're sending me now to a public junior high. No orientation. Just pushed me out the door, go to the bus stop. I didn't know what a homeroom was. I didn't know what a passing period meant. I was just terrified. So I learned to pray in a new way. It was called help. And I just wanted God to somehow come into my world and help me survive my junior high years. And he did. Next slide. So then, 11th grade, I came out of my shell. I was a gymnast, cheerleader, and so before I started my end of my junior year, I thought to myself, maybe God's like my dad. Maybe I can ask for things. Maybe he's generous. So I shot the moon. I said, "Dear God, I want to get straight A's. I want a letter in gymnastics. I want to be captain of the team." And then I said, "Oh, by the way, can I have a girlfriend?" It all came true. And the end of my senior year, I felt like I was the luckiest kid on the face of the earth, and it was the total gift of God. And I would leave my girlfriend's house in my 57 Thunderbird, you know, that little T-Bird. My dad had bought it new, and he gave it to me at 15 and a half. Fire engine red with a white top. I'd leave her house, driving home, and I would just be crying for half an hour, thanking God for my gifts. So, next slide. So then, I'll actually go back one. So my senior year, that was my junior year. My senior year, my friend was a student body president. He did two things for me. He introduced me to that young little blonde, and he also took me to my first Bible study, but I didn't know it was a Bible study, and that's why I went. It was Fellowship of Christian Athletes. And so at the union of the 101 and the 405 in Southern California is a big union bank building, 12 stories high. At the 12th floor was Dana Paulson's office. And my buddy says, "Hey, this ex-New York Jet, he's an all-pro. He's going to open up his office to high school athletes and talk about anything. We can talk about girls and sex and life. And he's going to throw in a little religion." And when he said that, my heart leapt. And you know, I've been praying since I was 11. So I went, and here's Dana Paulson with the Bible open, the first time I'd ever heard the scriptures. And I just fell in love with this man, and I just ate up everything. So I came to Christ that year, learned to pray out loud the first time. And then, being a Southern cowboy, the only school I wanted to go to was USC, because that's where my whole family went, and my dad taught there, the whole thing. Had a full scholarship there in gymnastics. But my sister says, "Well, why don't you just apply to the school called Stanford?" I didn't know Stanford existed or what it was. But I applied, and I got in, and the coach recruited me. And when I was on campus, I just felt God telling me, "This is where you're going to go." And when I told my mother, she was pretty upset because they didn't have any money for gymnastics. The team was last. The football team was terrible. She says to me, "Brian, you love football. The gymnastics team's terrible. You're not getting any. And your dad's got to pay for this." And so she built this whole thing. "You got to go tell your father." So here's my dad who never talks, and you can't talk to him until there's a commercial in the football game. And so I'm sitting next to him, terrified, and I says, I wait for the commercial. And I said, "Dad, I've decided where I want to go to school." Doesn't say anything. I said, "Dad, oh, yeah." And he says, "Oh, where are you going to go?" Now it comes up. "Stanford." He doesn't say anything. I says, "Well, so you didn't want to say anything?" He says, "I don't care where you go." And my mother always had this power trip to keep the power between us. So anyway, I went to Stanford. And now, here's why I went to Stanford. Stanford had that man as the college pastor, Dave Roper, founder of Cole Community Church. He's probably the best college pastor in the country. And my dad paid $20,000 for a Dave Roper education. I went there to be a stockbroker. With my ADD, I'd have been broke in a year. I was really good in math, but terrible in English. My SAT scores to get in there was 470 in English, so I could never read, you know. But anyway, so I go there, and I like men, so I join a frat house. Got to be with men. So I invited Dave to the frat house here on the left, the Theta Delta Chi. He'd always come in his little red VW. And I said, David, would you teach a Bible study in my frat house? And I learned, he said to me what he said to everybody, no. I'm going to teach you and you're going to teach it. I went, oh! I'm shy. I don't know the Bible. All I had read was the Good News for Modern Man, the Book of John, up to this point. And he says, no, you're going to invite me to dinner, and we're going to have a team meeting after dinner, and you're going to share your testimony, your fraternity brothers. I'll share the gospel. Then you're going to announce you're going to teach the Bible every Tuesday night. I did not sleep that entire week. He came, and this is, you know, this is the Vietnam War. This is where everybody's into drugs and free. We introduced free sex and alcohol and acid dropping and all that stuff. And here I am with my crew cut, and I'm going to teach a Bible study. So I learned to pray a new way. I said, dear God, would you bring four guys to Christ this year? So David would sit with me, and he would come in his little Volkswagen at 2 o'clock promptly. I would scribble down all his notes and then kind of read it backwards. And sure enough, four guys accepted Christ. And the fourth guy was at midnight before I went to go to Italy. Next slide. So David had taught me John and Romans. And then spring, summer that year, I went to Stanford in Italy. This is a view from my window, little orphanage down below, and over the city of Florence for 6 months. And when I was there, I'm with 80 non-Christian students who are there to smoke dope and drop acid and protest the Greek embassy for, you know, radical this and that. And I grabbed the microphone. The Lord just told me to teach, and I grabbed the microphone at one night and said, I'd like to teach a Bible study. 15 people showed up. And all I knew was John and Roman, so, you know, that's what I taught. And same results as in the frat house. So next slide. But then a big event happened. I did what every college kid does. You write home and you tell your parents the new things you're learning. So I wrote my mother a Mother's Day letter, told her how much I loved her, and it went over really big. And then here comes Father's Day. So I wrote my dad the Father's Day letter. Dear Dad, I love you. I said, do you sacrifice for me? I got a great education. I never regretted that you weren't home because I respected what you did. He'd always come home, you know, at 8 o'clock at night, exchange and call, he'd go back to the hospital. He left before I got up. But it never bothered me because I knew he was the best in the world. And he's probably the best surgeon in L.A. with his hands. I mean, he was so highly respected. And I said, I just respected you. I said, now I'm a Christian. And I said, I want to be about my Heavenly Father's business as well, like I was your son. You send it off the mail and you're waiting for the response. It never comes. Finally, about a month later, I get a postcard from my mother. And there's a little P.S. at the bottom. Dear Brian, knock off the religion. Your father's worried. That was a mound of emotion. And what really happened that night is my dad went to the dinner table, held up my letter, and he said, I've lost my one and only son. And the wall went up for 20 years. Because we don't talk in our family, we couldn't communicate, and the emotion was dense. My mother told me he didn't sleep all summer. He was devastated. So right after that, I got that letter. We ended up in Mykonos in Greece, and I was sharing Christ with a bunch of Stanford students in a discotheque. And I came out at full moon on the Aegean Sea, and the love of God just came out of heaven and surrounded me. And it tasted so sweet and so intense, I felt like I was just being adopted. I had a father now. And so, next slide. And then, Emily came over for the summer. And I got her a little pension near the Stanford Villa for like $40 for the summer. Stanford professors let her go to all the classes like she was a student. And what happened is I picked her up in Amsterdam, and in those days you stayed in youth hostels. I didn't know what I was doing, so I'm looking for the youth hostel. I get lost. I ended up in the red light district in Amsterdam. And this is, you know, it looks like Disneyland. The girls are in little windows, you know, and they're young and they're cute, and they're beckoning you with a finger to come in. And it was a Saturday, and I just read in Acts where God tells Paul, don't fear, I have people in this city. And I felt grieved, and I came around, of course, and said, Lord, you must have people in the city. Where are they? And I said, tomorrow's Sunday. I want to worship. And I walked around the corner, and here was Jop Osterhaus, that man at the top, school teacher. He'd go down to The Hague and preach to the drug addicts on Saturday nights. He grabs me, and he finds out I'm a Christian. He says, you're going to stay in my home. I picked up Emily. They put her, and so we stayed in a house church. Different house, and the state church in, you know, Holland's dead. It's all dead in Scandinavia. And so, and then they give us addresses in Copenhagen. We stayed there, and we go to Oslo. I meet Lena Solvent. She takes us to a party at midnight, where it's the longest day of the year, and all the Norwegians celebrate. And they give us addresses in Bergen, and then it's Germany and Switzerland. We never stay in youth hostel for 3 weeks. And I found out this body of Christ is this international congregation, this non-denominational. All they want to know is that you love Jesus and you have the Spirit in you, and it's family. My mom says, who is your travel agent? The whole time, too, I'd asked Emily to marry me right off the plane at 19, and we kept looking for a ring, and we found one in Lucerne, Switzerland, and I had the money. It was $200. Isn't that great? And we thought, let's have cheese fondue and talk about it. She thought, I think your folks will be upset if we come home engaged. Let's wait a year. So I bought her a watch as a consolation prize. And I thought, I wasted that moment because they were mad at me anyway. So anyway, next slide. So I continued the courtship. I wrote probably a letter. I had a voice. I wrote a letter a day for 4 years back and forth, sometimes two. We had these boxes. I threw them away so kids couldn't blackmail me. But I kept the ones from Italy. So we kept our relationship going, and then next slide, Dave Roper came to marry us. Look at that suit. I had no money, and I'm going to be an intern at PBC, and so I wanted kind of just a navy suit you could marry people in and bury people in and, you know, be a pastor in, and my mother takes me out. Oh, no, powder blue and white patent leather shoes, and of course, I never wore it again. But you can see how happy both sets of parents are. Dave Roper came to marry us. My mother threw him out of the house. He was not allowed to eat with us at rehearsal dinner. There was family tension was tough. Emily's parents hadn't seen each other since their divorce. So they're not very happy to see each other. And now she has remarried a Jewish communist welder who, when I first went to pick her up, there's both smoking dope on the couch and kind of hippie. It was like the big fat Greek wedding. My folks are the country club, John Birch Society. And so we just had a little few hors d'oeuvres and we left as quick as we could and came up. Now, what's interesting about my families, you learn all this later after they're gone, but our family never spoke and never had honest conversation, and I didn't find out till later. Well, I didn't know my dad had a sister till I was 13 because he never spoke. I didn't know my mother's, she was adopted. I didn't know her mother's name even till I was like 50. My mother's parents died. She grew up in Boston. Her father was a baker. She loved him. Her mother was a concert pianist. My mother was a concert cellist at 9. Two younger sisters. The father died at 7 on a streetcar. He got pneumonia. Her mother died at 9. So the three Gilchrist children are going to be adopted. And her mother wanted to go to this Mormon woman who was their accompanist. She was an opera singer, and only because of the music. This woman was not married, and she only got married to get these children. And it was an uproar in New England. And New England, the Boston Globe said, should the Gilchrist children be Mormons or Gentiles? And they were horrified they're going to take these three kids to the prairies and be Mormons. Turns out this woman was a lesbian, and she abused the youngest girl, my aunt. And that explained why my mother hated her and left home at 18. And my mother was a rebel, and so she survived by angry. But I discovered what, if you ever wronged my mother, she would never forgive you. And if you live your life that way, eventually you die with no friends. And so I never could be with my rest of my family because everybody wrongs you. My dad never spoke. And he left his Mormons. He thought it was a bunch of bunk. And so he was an agnostic. And my aunt's a Mormon and my other uncle's a Mormon. And so we had a lot of pain in our family. I had my oldest sister was married at 22. Her husband left her after the honeymoon. She lost the marriage in 16 days, had a nervous breakdown, and we never talked about it. My other sister went into drugs and really got on the bad side of my dad, went off into Hippieville, married a guy, found out how hard it is to can your own vegetables in Oregon. My mother wooed her back on a cruise to come back to the wealthy lifestyle. She repented and came back, divorced her husband, married a guy late. Also, at 15, she's pregnant. My folks don't find out till 5 months. My dad puts her into the hospital under our maid's name, so he's now disowned her and has his friend do the abortion illegally, kills the baby, and my sister almost dies. And I remember I was 13, waiting for the phone to ring. My dad was going to tell my mom whether my sister lived or not. And the phone rings, and my mom won't answer it. She's scared. And my sister made it. My mother had a nervous breakdown. We never talked about it. Never talked about it. Never discussed. Later, after she divorced the hippie, she marries a guy, and I did the wedding. And turns out he was an alcoholic, had been dry for 5 years, never told my sister, fell off the wagon on the honeymoon, was so ashamed of himself, my sister said, oh, it's not a problem for me, but then had committed adultery with her best friend to kind of pain himself. She lost the marriage in 16 days. He died of liver failure at 38 years old. We never talked about it. So I was pretty ill-equipped to handle pain or to process pain for the things I was about to encounter. So, next slide. So my seminary, if you want to know what my degree is, I have no degree. I only have had men who've loved me, and I wouldn't trade it for the world. I actually applied to go to the Dallas Seminary twice, and our board of elders said, why don't you stay at our church? We'll give you all the training you want while you're a pastor. And I had no idea what that entailed, but I wouldn't trade it for anything now. So the first group of elders we had that started our church were the godliest group of guys, cutting-edge men, all went to the grave loving their wives, all did not want limelight, all just loved to share Christ. So this is the Motley Crue on our trip to Israel in 1976, and it was a great seminary for me to be around men, because I hungered for men as a kid. Next slide. And then my other education is my children. So I thought in my life that, but this estrangement with my dad was so painful to me because he was the most important person in my life. I thought, well, dear God, maybe if I have a son, that'll touch my dad. Because, you know, how can a grandpa, and none of my sisters had kids. My kids are the only grandparents my parents had. So I had a son, and what did I name him? The best name in the Bible, David Jonathan, which was the story I loved, which means beloved gift of God. But then day six, he gets sick. And no one knows what's wrong. Immediately, I called Dave Roper. I needed a dad. So he's with us, and David just gets more sick, go to intensive care. All of a sudden, he's up in San Francisco to intensive care. We have to move up there. We're there for 6 days. I called my dad. I couldn't talk on the phone. I just was crying. So my mom and dad came up. And I know my dad's heart was broken, but he had new emotion. I needed a hug. And my dad had no idea what was wrong. He thought maybe a brain hemorrhage or something. But as he's leaving, he puts his hand on mine, and then he leaves, and it's a $100 bill. And then they left. David died, and they weren't there for the funeral. That's the way my dad did emotion. So David died at 9 days. And I think we processed our grief pretty well because everything's unknown. You're just crying, you're laughing, you're with fellowship, you're with friends. We had a memorial service. We made a mistake, and then we let the hospital take care of the body. And then next year, we get pregnant again, and the amniocentesis is the baby's a healthy little girl. We redo the room for this little girl, Jessica Lynn. We're all excited, and she's born November 30, 1 year later. Third day, she's sick. And when my wife calls me, but I had a theology at that time that said, God's sovereign, God's good. The odds of healthy kids is good because we only had a 1 out of 4 chance of this happening. Having that happen twice in a row is 1 out of 16. So roll the dice. You'll never roll 1 out of 4-sided dice twice in a row, you know. And I'd given my firstborn to God, so I had in my theology, this will never happen again. God will never ask that of me again. So I went into that pregnancy, and when I was in the hospital, there was David, and I told David my theology, Jessica's going to be fine. And he looked at me. With the look, go back, keep it back. He looked at me with a look that I knew he knew, but he couldn't tell me. So I made one last trip to the hospital to see her in intensive care at Stanford, and she's all hooked up, and all the emotions come flooding back. And I saw her there, and I just wanted to weep. But I had an elder with me, and I was embarrassed, so I shoved it, and then I shut down because I knew the ending. I went home, and I'm not with my daughter. I'm not bonding with her. It's too hard for me. And then I called the next day on Saturday to see, well, how's Jessica? And the nurse goes, well, she expired. That's how I found out she died. And it was so painful. The hospital took care of the body. We didn't even have a memorial service because we didn't want to be the morbid Morgans, you know, burying a kid every year. And then away from the hospital, God I just felt this movement of the Spirit. I said, honey, let's not put away the baby furniture. Let's just pray for a baby. So this was Saturday. I told one of our pastors, I said, in the service the next night, would you have the congregation pray for us? She says, I think God's doing something. So this was December 4th. December 5th is the service. The pastor's wife gets up and says, dear God, give him a baby by Christmas. Kind of arrogant. Who prays that? And there was a gal whose roommate was due to deliver the next day, had not told her doctor she was giving a baby up for adoption. She went home, told her roommate that we'd lost 2 kids. She says, I want them to have my baby. Next slide. So Rebecca Noel was born a week before Christmas. So Jessica dies Saturday. Sunday we find out we're going to be parents. And here's this gift. We were going to name her Rebecca Louise, and we're going to the hospital. The attorney says, what are you going to name her? It's Rebecca Louise. He says, why don't you name her Rebecca Noel? She's a Christmas gift. So we did. And Emily says, you think we can pray? She looks like us. So the lawyer read the deal. The mother is 5'2", blonde hair, blue eyes, German background. The guy's 5'8", ugly. No. anyway, she looked exactly like Emily. And Rebecca dried our tears. Next slide. So here she is at Christmas time. Emily was able to nurse her because she'd just given birth. Next slide. And then 18 months later, Jenny's born. And so now my theology is changing and my prayers are changing. First, it's God won't require anything. When Jessica died, I learned God can require anything. I have no right to be a parent. I can't take an Old Testament promise and make it new. And then when I got Becky, it's being a parent's a gift. All children are the gift of God. And then when we got Jenny, it was like God did for me what he did for Job. I got 2 in heaven. I got 2 here. I got a family. I got 4 kids. This is beyond belief. And daughters worked their way into my heart. I kept these father-daughter memory books because I never got anything from my dad, any speech. So I kept track of memories I'd had with him, little outings for 18 years before they went to college. And when they go to college, they give me these 5 volumes. I just want to know Dad loved them. A terrible disciplinarian. But just know I love you. You're a gift. Amen. Next slide. And then I had these great years as college pastor where I first met Jackson. And this was a gift. Now, I need to tell you, the first conversation I ever had with Jackson,
You know, I mean, I came in and we had this meeting at this person's house, and he came to me. The first thing he said to me, was comfort for losing my kids. I don't know if you remember that. First thing he said to me, he says, I'm really sorry, I heard what happened. He lost two kids. Next slide. So then we get pregnant again. Now every time we get pregnant, you got to pray for 9 months because you don't know if the kids are going to live or die. So Jackson's at dinner with us, and Emily's in pretty close to giving birth. And he looks at his watch. It's almost 6:30. He says, I got to go. I says, where are you going? He says, don't you know? We're spending 24 hours of prayer for you today. 48 students, each taking a half an hour. It's my half hour. I got to go pray. So he went to my bedroom, shut the door. And when our jaws dropped, I've never been loved like this before. And he comes out. He's smiling, you know, and confident. And so Katie was born, and we get the results that... We can throw our medicine away. She's going to be okay. And I raced up to the Stanford campus. The kids were in Bible study. I said, God answered your prayers. 48 students praying. I mean, who can handle love like that? Next slide. So then I thought, I need to return the favor for Jackson. So Jackson, I really set him and Jeannie up. I took Jeannie to Urbana without Jackson and told her about this great guy. And to do a lot. So next slide. So, you know. Anyway, we get them all set up together. And next slide. So first date, I don't know, this front of our house, kind of getting them to go together here. Next slide. Yeah. Well, next slide. There. He says, my mom bought me this shirt. I hope she likes it. Is that 70s or what?
Did we have a copy of that?
No. Yeah. Yeah, it'll be on the website tomorrow. Yeah. All right, next one. But it doesn't take him long. They start pumping out the kids. And, yeah.
That's Josh.
Yeah, oh, man. He's wide awake. A scholar. Next one. And then we were matchmaking. And so, fun. So what was neat, it's not often couples become close. Usually it's like one guy, one gal, you know, but... My wife loved Jeannie, and I loved Jackson, and it was so painful for us when they had to leave. If it was 4 years, it seemed like a lifetime to me, but anyway, go ahead, next one. And now here's our clan, the Morgan family, and so I never thought I'd be a dad. And I get 3 daughters, and now we got 4 grandkids. So my adopted daughter has 3 kids, and then Katie and Steve have a little Ty born May 31st. So... Next slide. So getting back to story and poem and having a voice, suffering did a lot to me. It made me feel the capacity to pain. I discovered if you go through it, it increases your capacity to feel joy and love. If you don't stuff it, if you go through it, you have a greater capacity for appreciation. Now, I figured out the power of story early in my ministry. So in 1985, I took 12 guys on a backpack trip. And each day, we tell a guy, okay, you're going to tell your story today. And then you next day, so on. So we had 12 days, 12 guys. Each guy tells their life story. Well, the first one's G. Very general and very bland. Next guy goes, well, maybe I'll go PG. He gets a little more vulnerable. Next guy goes PG-13. Next guy goes, oh, heck with y'all, I'm going R. Lays it all out there, and the guys find out when they're open with each other, and when you really know a guy and how he went up the mountain, and you're just kind of going up the mountain with him, and you're getting the vistas like he got him, you love the person. You don't judge him. You just feel this love. So the next guys, it's all kind of going out the door, and they're just sharing everything, and it was an incredible adventure. So from that point on, anybody that was around me, you can't be in my group, you ain't telling your story. And the whole point is, as men, we want to know each other. We want to know each other at the deepest levels. So I'd had that in my little tool bag, and because the whole Bible story, right? And if the Bible is very honest. I mean, there's no saint there that you don't see the dirty laundry. It's all out there in spades, from their thought life and everything else. So, next slide. But I didn't know poetry. Now, I loved Hebrew. And I love teaching Hebrew stuff, but I never thought about doing it or having that as an expression of my own voice. I never had a class in poetry, never had a class in English literature. And what it took is I was 38 years old, and I ended up in Romania in 1988. This is Ceausescuville. This is communism. And we had to train for this because everything we're going to do is illegal. And we're going with a group called the Lord's Army. It's an evangelical arm of the Orthodox Church. And it was founded by a poet. This poet spent 17 years in prison. They took all his poetry, beat his parents to a pulp, took 25 years of his poems, burned it in an ox cart, shoved him in prison. The men I met who were with Trondors in prison said the happiest days of their lives were being with him because he brought Christ to the prison. All he had in prison was his memory. So he recreated by memory one poem a day on a glass shard, a matchstick, spit, and a cloth, and he'd rub the lime off the prison walls, spit, and make a palette and write his poem and memorize it. Day one. Day two, he'd do day one and two. All the way, he'd get 30. Eventually, he'd get out in short periods, commit into writings, he'd throw him back into prison, and so on. How many poems he ended up with, recreating in memory? 10,000. When we were there, first year, next slide, I didn't know who he was. These people are rationed 5 eggs a month. There's no food in the country. He's just a lot of alcohol. Everybody's alcoholic. The minute you landed in Bucharest, you could feel this oppression, this satanic oppression. We couldn't be in their homes. That was illegal. But they put us in their homes. They didn't care. Everybody's spying on everybody else. And then we come with these people. They open up these little hymnals. There's no music. There's 1,000 poems in this thing. And they're singing the music by heart. And all of a sudden, I'm watching these people go to heaven on these songs. And I couldn't understand it, but you just watch them. It's like one verse after another. And then right at the pinnacle of the song, they stop in this holiness. And it's like they're right underneath God's throne. And they feel God's presence. And you just see them and they're weeping. And then they start verse 3-4 and they come down, they're back on earth. I thought to myself, we are missing something in the West. You know, we do our little praise courses, they don't go anywhere, you just whip it up by repetition, but this is Elijah's chariot. Well, then I met him. Next slide. Still not working? There he is. I go to my room, he's in my house. And I see him, and I've never seen or felt anybody this holy in my life. And he's a small man. He was a peasant. He just had this gift. And when I saw him, he looked me right in the eye, and he pulled me to his eye, and he said, "You teach about the cross. We live under the cross." And I felt like that big. I went, and then he started praying for me in his Romanian cadences, and I needed no translation. I knew he was praying that I would know the presence of Christ that he knew in suffering. So I went to my room, and I woke up like at 3 in the morning just asking the Lord, give me a tenth of the Spirit. So next slide. So I smuggled out. So this was what Pablo Neruda wrote is exactly how I felt, that poetry came in search of me, and I didn't know where it was. And it wasn't sounds, but it just broke into my life and just sent me into orbit. The neat thing about my spiritual journey, I have never gone to school to learn the theory about something and then find the experience. God always gives me the experience first, and then you have passion to study the rest of your life. And that's the way this has been. I experience poetry and what it's designed to do in speech. So, next slide. So, I took out one of his hymnals, and I didn't know how am I going to get out of the country. And I had to beg one of the guys, if you give it to me, I promise I'll bring it back. I don't know how, but I'm going to print these. So I stuck it in my sleeping bag. And in those years, when you come out of the border into Hungary, the Securitate come, they tear the train car apart, pull the seats out, the dogs come sniffing. Sometimes you hear somebody screaming because they found somebody trying to get away, a woman and her child, and you hear this gut-wrenching scream. And it's terror when you cross the border. And they went through all my stuff. But they felt around the sleeping bag and they never went inside of it. And I got it out. We had a Jew in our congregation who had such a great experience in Romania. He took his entire father's inheritance and he published 20,000 of these. Now, how do you get them back in? So we put them in a semi-truck, and my buddy drove it across Europe. And right when he gets to Romania, the revolution happened, and it was total chaos at the border, and it went across the border. Nobody looked at the truck. Got in 20,000 hymnals, and when you gave them to the people, they just started weeping. Tremendous thing. Next slide. So then when I came home, Stanford professor John Felstener, he spent 17 years with another Romanian poet writing his stuff. Next slide. Paul Celan. And he just said casually to me one time, oh, by the way, the most a poem can do is this. And when it does this, it's explosive. And my ears picked up. Next slide. Because he said, when a poem brings four worlds together, the world of creation, the world of history, spirituality, and you, when all that merges, the poem becomes explosive. Now, this had happened to me in 1989 in Romania, the second year I went back, because when I went back, the Securitate knew who we were, and they knew we were coming, and they tried to arrest me. And I was in Cluj, and my stuff was in this guy's house, and the Securitate came to arrest me, and I was gone. And he gathers all my stuff, and he comes to get me. Now, if he's found out, he goes to prison. If I'm found out, they just kick me out of the country. He finds me in the street, grabs me in broad daylight, and hugs me. All he wants to do is give me a bedspread his wife made for us and say that he loves me. His name is Big John. We're studying the David-Jonathan story and what happens in that story. Jonathan dies for David. And this happened to me not once, not twice, four times, and all the guys' names were Jonathan. It's like I'm reliving the story while it's happening. So the second week, next slide, we go up into the hills. And I think we're safe in the Securitate. And here the Romanians were studying like this. And then right after I took that picture, the Securitate come up over the hill, and I think I'm dead. And all those Romanians jumped up, did a soccer game as a diversion. The four Americans ran off into the forest to save our lives. And now what are we going to do? Well, you can't study out in the open anymore. You have to study inside that big tent. And I'm placed to stand watch right there looking down at that road. Now, I've never had to stand watch for my life before while we're studying, but I thought, well, that's what David did. Now, what did David do when he stood watch? So I just did kind of the charismatic thing. I'm in the Psalms. I just pick a random song. Boom. I read Psalm 27. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The evil man came, and he stumbled and fell. But you hide me in the secret place of your tent with songs of joy. I'm reading that, and I hear the tent where they're singing, and the enemy that forced us into the tent, that love that I first felt at Mykonos, is now in the eyes of all the Romanians. And it's intense, and it's indescribable. And in the process, more of those Jonathans put their life on the line for me. And as we're going out, we felt we had to leave a day early. The Securitate was just getting in too tight. 20 minutes after we left, they came to arrest us and we were gone. And they were so angry because they knew we were there. And Jonathan went on ahead of us 500 yards out of the way of the forest to lead the way. I'm making no contact with him because if I talk to him, he's arrested. So at one point, he sits by a stream, takes his shoes off to wash his feet. And I got all this Romanian money and I want to get rid of it. So I sneak over and put the money in his shoe and then I go back and then I see the green car of the Securitate and Jonathan's gone. And I think I have caused him to be arrested. And you have no idea what it feels like when you think you cost somebody their life. And I'm living with this heaviness. And then half an hour later, he appears out of the bushes that they didn't get him. And you're filled with relief. But I've never been loved like that before. How do you have a voice for that? People put their life on the line for you. And you're never the same after that. So next slide. So here was the tent. We were in where that love was experienced, and that psalm. So here's how the poem works now. That's the David story, right? The David story becomes the Christ story, and now in that layer becomes your story, and you're out in creation where the whole thing's coming together, and all those four worlds come together. That's explosive. And that explains why some hymns mean more to you than other people, because there's layers of history, creation, life, all merging together. Next slide. So in 1994, it goes on, I grabbed Jackson and a bunch of other buddies, and we're going to take my mentor, Hebrew mentor, Bruce Waalke, probably the best Hebrew scholar in the country, who has gave me everything he had over the last 30 years. I feel in his debt. We went to Israel in search of Adullam, the cave where David wrote Psalm 142. So we were called the men of Adullam. I had Adullam shirts, and we're going, and we find the cave. So in the cave, we read Psalm 142 back to King David. I'm thinking he was here 3,000 years ago and composed that song, and now here we are reliving it. God bless you. So we're leaving. Jackson was a fireman in the country, so he has a sense of topography. The other guy, Bernard Bell, studied topography and surveying at Cambridge. And as we leave, Jackson goes, "I don't think that was the right cave." And Bernard goes, "Yeah, I don't think so either." I go, "How do you know? I mean, come on here, the cave." "Oh, Bernard, no." Next day, Bernard goes to Jerusalem, gets a Hebrew topo map, says, "No, yeah, we were off. It was over here." So we have to go back and relive the experience, but it was a great experience. So next slide. So each night, I had each guy write a poem about his life and to share it at dinner. And we go to the best French restaurant in Israel. It's called Katie's in Jerusalem. My elder paid for this. He says, "Just wine and dine yourselves. You got Waalke with you. Enjoy yourself." So that night, Jackson does his poem. It's called "Someone Lied." He reads his poem, and when he's done, the air is so holy, none of us can talk. When we went into the restaurant, we were met by the owner, Katie. And she goes, "Oh, hi, God. How are you?" And she sits beside us, kind of groping on us. She sits down at our table a little bit forward. "How can I help you?" She has a little bit too much to drink. She says, "Who are you guys anyway? Well, we're five pastors." She freaked out, was ashamed, and went bolted into the kitchen. After Jackson read his poem, I said, "Jackson, go read your poem to Katie." So he goes to the kitchen, reads her the poem. She comes out. She's crying. "Who are you guys?" So Jackson and I had sung Psalm 25 for years together. So he and I just a duet, Psalm 25. "To thee, O Lord, I lift up my soul." The piano player starts playing. The Arab waiter's a Christian. He's all excited. The place erupts. I think we shared Christ till 1 in the morning. And so finally I turned to Bruce. I said, "Well, where's your poem?" He says, "I don't do poetry." I says, "You teach Hebrew poetry." And he was actually having a hard time on the trip when we first went. What's the next slide look like? Did I go there? No, go back. So go back one more slide. Yep. So, and he wanted to take a day off. And so he takes a day off, and he read Dave Roper's book on Psalm 23. At the end of the day, he's just a new person. And I said, "What happened to you, Bruce?" He said, "Well, I came here pretty broken. I was tired. And I'm watching you guys, and you're loving people everywhere. My whole life I've hid behind words." Just like that. "Fred, that's your wife. You better call her." Yeah. It's okay. She wants to know who's the heretic he's listening to. And and he admitted that when he'd gone to Israel with us in 1976, he had spent 3 weeks translating the NIV. Then he went with us for 2 weeks, and it tore his marriage. And now he's watching us, and he feels like he's just dead inside. And he read a T.S. Eliot poem that David had put in Psalm 23 about the things reserved for old age, when you think you did good things and they come back to haunt you. And he said, "You know, the Lord met me," and he says, "I'm going to go home and cancel all my speaking engagements. And I'm no longer going to teach for money. I'm going to teach for love." And he just was animated, became a whole new person the whole trip. And after he gets back, a month later, I get this poem in the mail from the Adullam cave. And this is the Eremos cave on the right down there. This is the cave where Jesus overlooked the Sea of Galilee and used to pray. And we laid hands on him to pray for healing, and we made a little memorial stone to him. Now, a couple things bring you up to date. I went and checked the website about Katie's restaurant to see if I could find that picture earlier. And it's still there, and I was reading the reviews. And you won't believe this. All the reviews, fantastic food. But Katie gropes all over us still. This is 20 years later. What is she, 80? And she's fleecing people for money. So it's like, you want to get taken, go there, because she's going to sit down with you. She said they sat down at our table and breathed all over us, and she's still the same. But I got an email from Bruce this morning before I left. And he says, guess what? He says, my wife's memory's kind of gone now, but our marriage is totally different. She says, and the prayers that you guys prayed for me back in Adullam have been answered today. And she just sits next to me and tells me how much she loves me. And he was like a little boy in a candy store. So he went to Regent College at the seminary and read his poem at chapel and broke his heart open to all these seminary students. This is incredible. Okay, next slide. Keep going. Now, the life-changing research I started to do when I came back from Romania was this poem, When David's Lament Over Jonathan. And I'll share this tomorrow, but this is the thing I've discovered about poetry that is the most beautiful gift poetry can give, and that you can recover moments that you've lost. I lost those moments with my daughter. I was not her dad. I regret that. But I got to relive it in poetry and recreate it and sanctify that time. And you see this stone? My buddy Jim Ziegler made this for us, who works at a graveyard, and brought that to my house to seal the deal. Anyway, next slide. So then after we got this, I started traveling on the wings of a poem with my buddy Bob Bunce, who was the lover of the church. He was everybody's father. And, you know, certain people in life, and I'd say about this, all my friends here, I can't wrong these guys. You know, some guys just love you so much, you can't wrong them. You could never wrong Bob Bunce. He always had one expression, who cares? And he'd just hug you. And even when he rebuked you, it'd feel good. You know, and I'd get arrogant. You know, he'd pop my, oh, it feels good. Do it again. And so we went all over. We probably did the conference we're doing now. I probably did it 50 times with Bob. One time we were in Colorado, 14,000 foot peaks, you know, we're below. We're with all the tough cowboys. And you mentioned Friday night you're going to do poetry. And I have a Romanian with me. And they don't think the Romanian understands English. So when I tell the guys they're going to write their own psalms and poetry, now everybody's in their bunks, and you have the cowboy and the Romanian and the cowboy. And one cowboy says to the other one, hey, Frank, where are these guys from anyway? He goes, California. California, bunch of sissies. Well, you know what? His was the first poem. He had a big handlebar mustache, big hat, barely see over his eyes. He starts off by saying, I come up here all tired and forlorn, and Brian says, write a poem. And then he pours out his life. Divorce, alcoholism, lost his first marriage, remarried, estranged from his daughter, poured it all out. And that started the whole deal. 2.5 hours worth. So Bob has Alzheimer's now, and he's gone. He's not dead, but he's gone. His last words to me, this typical Bob, I went to see him before Christmas, and we're sitting there at lunch, and his wife is there, and finally, after the middle of lunch, she goes, hey, Bob, Brian's here. You know the rabbi? He rolls his eyes, and he goes, oh, some people you just can't get rid of. And it was kind of like, last tag, you're it, and I'm going to die now. And, you know? So he had the last word. So now I don't have Bob to travel with. And now it's a little bit different. The B team, next slide, it's a little weirder. Oh, no. By the way, I could never get Bob to do a poem about all my travels. Finally, 2002, we're in Romania. And after the trip, all the teams gather together for the leaders' meeting. Now you have priests present where you're supposed to behave yourself because the priests don't like us, right, Marty? You know that. Yeah, yeah. And they have a file on me that's as big as a securitate because they hate me. So I'm always told to behave myself. So each group would get up and share their poem with the group as the representative. So Bob finally says, I have a poem. I go, great. So he gets the mic and he says in front of the priests, roses are not always red. Violets are not always blue. Bob's not a poet, and Brian's not a Jew. It's like, Wait. Okay. Yeah. So next slide. So then we went back to Romania, and we decided to the Romanians, it wasn't enough Crown Doors gave you poems. You guys don't have a voice. You have to write your own. So after every conference, we tell them, you're somewhere in this story. Tell us where you are and write your poem. So the girl in the middle is like my daughter. She comes to me and says, well, I'll tell you my story. I hate my father. He's an alcoholic. He's the town drunk. He died when I was 13. And that kid's always made fun of me, you know, as he'd be drunk in a ditch. You know, in a small town in Romania, it's the laughing stock. And I never told him I loved you. So I said, you know what, Gabi, I'll be your dad, and I'll write you. And so we became kind of father-daughter. Well, this year, 1998, she then says, her poem is about her mother. And her mother says, you know, your father and I never wanted you. We wish you were dead. And I'm going to go across the street and live with this non-Christian guy. You take care of your brother and grandma. She'd see her mother on the streetcar. Her mother would not even acknowledge her presence. So she's been... She's a beautiful girl. I mean, disowned. That was just one story, one poem. She's able to articulate that. And the title of her poem, you know that story, the Jairus' daughter, where Jesus says to the little girl, Talitha kum, which means little girl arise. Her poem was Mama kum. Mama will arise from the dead. Her mother, now she has two kids, still doesn't see her mom. So, next slide. So then we went back, and what's interesting, I got all the 20-year-olds, because I noticed the 40-year-olds weren't changing, because communism would not allow them to be vulnerable, and I live for vulnerability. So I said, I want the 20-year-olds, they all speak English, but the interesting thing is, they can't be part of the group unless they share their story. And that was really hard, because they all knew each other, all grew up together, and none of those kids in their 20s was known. And it was like pulling teeth. But once one shared and they found out the freedom, the other one would share. We'd get them all together in these 3 years of conferences, but there was no church in Romania I could send them to where vulnerability and honesty could be cultivated. And it was so, still today, when I go there, it happens. When we leave, it disappears. These kids have no elders to help them stay vulnerable. It's amazing. Next slide. So now this is what I have to travel with. This is the B team, the guys who are with me. It's a little bit harder crew, but next slide. This is, yeah, so these are the guys that I get now. Next slide. Sometimes we have to go incognito. And we don't often get invited back. So that's often why you travel with a team, too, because sometimes you get stoned together. And anyway, next slide. So Ken and I did this in Albania. Think of this. So. And I only had 2.5 hours to get pastors ready to do their poetry. I don't know if it was going to work. And it was supposed to be, it was John Stott sent us over there to teach exposition. So I'm teaching Psalms. And I teach the guys what we're going to do. One guy gets up and says, I'm not doing this. This is not exposition. I'm not going to share in front of these guys. And he gets all upset. And I think I'm going to get fired. And then it comes. So here they are up on this table up at the top. And the first guy goes, I'm healed. I go, what do you mean you're healed? In their culture, the youngest son takes care of the parents, and he was taking care of their parents, and it goes on forever. And he finally moved them out of their house to his village, and the dad fell down the stairs and died, and the village would not forgive the son, and he's living with this guilt. Now, as he's articulating it, he goes, I'm healed. And he's just incredible. The next guy gets up, and he says, I'm here like King David because my uncle killed somebody. And in northern Albania, it's the mafia system. They wrote him a letter, and they said, we can't find your uncle, and you're the next bloodline. Nothing against you, but we have to kill you. So he came to the conference seeking the refuge like David did from the enemy. Incredible time. All these guys opened up within 2 hours and learned to death. But the greatest trip we did was Croatia. Next one. So... this, I thought, was going to be my dream job because I get invited to go to the evangelical seminary in Croatia. They want to be the leading evangelical seminary in Eastern Europe. My task is to teach the Psalms 2 weeks in English, and some of the students know Hebrew. I go, whoa. Well, I get there, and I find out they're, I think, first of all, I take a bunch of books thinking they don't have anything. It's an $11 million building, but it's in Osijek, next slide, which really looks like this. This is where the Serbs came, and all these kids are traumatized by war. And they spent so much money on the building, they couldn't afford to feed the students. The library had 30,000 volumes. And they had a dean who was like a Nazi. And she was, I won't go into it. But, you know, she's spying on the kids, making sure, it's just legalistic. And it's like, where's the love in this place? And there was some really good professors, but the academic load was way too deep. And so I canceled all the afternoon classes. We took the kids out to dinner. Next slide. Here's the class. I found out, I go in at naive teaching, I found out these kids like each other because you have Serbs, you have Croatians, you have Macedonians, Albanians are at the bottom, and Romanians and so on, and they like each other. And then this kid with thick glasses is a master's student. He's saying, you know, David didn't even write this stuff. You know, blah, 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 blah. I said, you know what, Alexander, you give your paper to somebody else. Because this is my life. I live on these Psalms. And it's not academic to me. So next slide. So we take these kids out to dinner. And then the seminary has a lockdown at, I don't know, 11 o'clock. And so we had to hop the fence and throw rocks at the window to get back in. And they have a camera on us. So the professors are sneaking back in every night with the students. And then we stole the van one day. And we grabbed four couples who'd never had a honeymoon. And my buddy worked at HP. So I stole his credit card. And we put them up at a four-star hotel overnight. Said, you're not coming to class. Just enjoy yourself, da-da-da. So what's the next slide look like? So Thursday night's going to be the poem night. And now the nerds come, and they start coming to me, and they say, hey, we have to be honest in these poems? I go, yeah. He says, well, we're not going to be honest in front of them because we don't like them. I said, well, no poem, no grade. But I won't rape you. You write your poem in honest, and if you feel free on Poetry Night, you share. If not, I'll listen privately to you in my room. So the tension builds Thursday night. Next slide. Oh, sorry, this one. Go back. Here's out. This guy's brave enough to do it first. He sticks a thing in the VCR, and it's a documentary about his brother, who's a mountain climber, who's going to be the first kid in the team from Macedonia to climb Mount Everest. And this thing's a half an hour long, and the ropes and everything else, and then it's done. And then he goes, he's killed in an avalanche before he even got there. Four guys were killed. Nobody in that room knew that his brother had died, and now they know. That opens the gate. Next slide. They all start opening up. This girl on the right top, her poem starts, it was 1991 when the war started. I was 5 years old. She lived in Vukovar. Vukovar was Auschwitz. Leveled. Most of these kids fled from their lives. Some lived in Switzerland, where they were abused by teachers for being foreigners. Called fat, ugly, had to become anorexic to survive. Other kids fled to other countries. And now they're in seminary, and nobody's wanting to know who they are. The most incredible poem, next slide, was this gal. So for the entire length of the war, she lived in a basement with no food or water. Her face was black. And then they hear noise. The Croatian troops come. The war's over. You can come out. And then they put a gun to her head, and they said, we're going to kill you because you didn't fight for us. Finally, a neighbor screams from across the way, she did fight for us. So they lied to save her life. And she thinks, somebody put their life on the line to save my life. Then she marries a Croatian officer, and she has a little girl who's there. She's 12 years old. And all of a sudden she says, you know, I don't know who my husband really is. So she does a little research and finds out he already married. He's got girlfriends in every city. So she leaves him. She goes to live with her parents, with her little girl, and he comes to get her. She says, I'm not going. He says, fine. He goes, he comes back, knock on the door, and the father's sitting there. She's sitting with the daughter and the mother. He comes in, he has a gift in his pocket, takes it out, pulls the pin, tosses the grenade in the living room. Her father jumps on the grenade, blows his legs off. And she says, he's in constant pain, but he's so happy to have his daughter and his granddaughter. And I'm his legs, and I take him everywhere. Jesus jumped on the grenade of my sin, and I'm his legs, and I take him everywhere. She served me communion. That was a holy moment. So next slide. So this went on from 8 till midnight. 30 students who didn't like each other. All of a sudden they're known. And at the end I said, well, there's good news and bad news. Bad news is we're staying up longer because we're going to have communion. You're going to serve each other. The good news is I held up my psalm book. I said, y'all got an A. There's no paper. Probably why I wasn't asked back. But I said, you've all done it. You've all climbed the mountain. You all put the ropes in. This is not theory to me. You did it. And you're going to do it the rest of your life. So here they are doing communion. And you can see the intimacy start to develop between them. And finally at the end, last slide, they're a family. A real family. I took all those poems with all their pictures and made a book and sent it to the faculty. I said, these are your students. Nobody said anything. And the dear Romanian professor who had me there, who was the dean, who sat in my class, they couldn't afford to keep him and he had to leave. And then the school asked me to send money to their programs. And I thought to myself, is there no place that cares about the soul as well as the academics? You know, I thought here, to me, this was so monumental to bring the Balkan states and make them holy. Through what? The power of the poem. That's it. Next slide. So last summer, we went back to Romania. Again, same results. This group did not know us. They were scared to death of us, thought we were all crazy to start. But then what happens? They become a family. They all share. They all get a voice. That's a wonderful thing to see. Next slide. So, do you have a voice? Next slide. This is what will happen on Sunday. We'll all applaud as we hear you share. So, other than that, I have no opinion. It is an amazing little tool, and the Lord has been very gracious to use it as one way to get up the mountain. So, I'm done for this evening. Sorry for, I have no idea what time it is, but don't shoot me yet. I got a bodyguards back here. They're big guys. So, all yours.